All right, thanks for joining me, everyone. Charles Moskowitz, Monday through Friday, 3 to 4 p.m. here at Rumble and Subscribing Networks. And my guest is the author of Parents of the World Unite, How to Save Our Schools from the Left's Agenda. Ian Pryor is one of the most recognizable voices in the parents' revolution that has swept the country. Ian, you are emanating from Loudoun County Public Schools, which was, I think it's safe to say, the epicenter of this revolution. So talk a little bit about that and how you got into it and what was your involvement in that particular situation?
Yeah, absolutely. And thanks for having me. The controversies in Loudoun County really started in 2020. Like a lot
of
school districts.
Can you tweak up your volume a little bit? I need to hear more sound.
Sure. Does this work better? Check one. Better?
A little bit. A little more.
A little more? Good.
There we go. Much
okay.
better.
Okay. The controversies in Loudoun County Public Schools really started in the summer of 2020, like a lot of places in the country where, you know, schools were closed. You had a lot of parents organizing to push back on that and try and reopen schools. At the same time, in about the fall of 2020, you had parents that were, you know, at home looking at what was going on with their children's education because schools were closed, seeing it on the Chromebooks, being, you know, very concerned with, you know, some of the ways of that their children are being taught. When we talk about critical race theory and elements of that certainly were in a lot of these lessons and guidance periods that the children had. And I certainly became one of those parents, and I sent a Freedom of Information Act request to Loudoun County Public Schools to find out about a consulting company that they had hired, the Equity Collaborative. And they had hired this company a year before to do an equity audit, do focus groups. And, you know, Loudoun County based their whole their plan to end systemic racism on this equity report. So I was curious as to, one, where the systemic racism was, but also, two, how much did they pay for this? And I found out they paid $500,000 for it. And later I learned that they kept them on for $625 an hour for 2 years to help implement these programs. So I wrote an article in the Federalist in late September, early October of 2020, and that was about the extent of it. In March of 2021, things really, you know, reached an inflection point where you had a group of local activist parents in a group called Facebook group called the Anti-Racist Parents of Loudoun County. Had about 800 members, including six school board members, administrators, teachers, our Soros-backed prosecutor. And these activists decided they wanted to make a list of, you know, insufficiently woke people in the county that were pushing back at the school board on things like school closures and critical race theory.
Let me just pause on that one for a second.
Sure.
So, I mean, that's pretty intimidating. They're making a list with that's like a doxing. I mean, did they include people's addresses? I mean, were they, you know, that's sort of, like here in Boston, they made a list of people who support the state of Israel. I mean, including rabbis, you know, and they were like publicizing it. I mean, it was really ugly. And what was worse about it was that Senator Elizabeth Warren supported it, as did the so-called squad. So this is an intimidation tactic that is becoming all too common. So anyway, go on.
Yeah, so that's exactly right. I mean, there were people in there that were suggesting, well, we need to infiltrate these parent groups that are opposed to school policies. We need to publicly expose them. You know, one woman even said we need to hack their websites. Know any hackers that can hack their websites and redirect them to pro-critical race theory websites. And then another woman said, all right, well, we list them, right? We'll list them by their names, their area of residence, and their school board member. They proceeded to list something like 60 to 70 people. And, you know, the irony is the script got flipped on them because their group got infiltrated. And what they were talking about was publicly exposed. And that really rocked the county and made national news in March. And certainly at that time, I thought to myself, you know, I'm not going to back down from this fight. You're not going to have people in communities trying to cancel each other over policies and disagreement in policies, especially when it comes to schools. And, you know, the fact that you had teachers, administrators, school board members that were in this group, some of whom were, you know, involved in this, and it just didn't sit well. And you wonder, what are they teaching our children to be like? Is this an example to set for children that if somebody has a different viewpoint than you or wants to argue a policy, you know, you need to have them ostracized and no longer be productive members of society. Right. So we ended up forming a group called Fight for Schools, and we launched a petition to remove six of those school board members, which required us to go out and get signatures from the community. And it created this grassroots team that was out there every day for 6 months, you know, talking to members of the community about what was going on in public schools, going on, you know, television, going on radio. And you know, that really galvanized the movement here in Loudoun County, so much so that you had all these parents with different skill sets, whether it was organizing, whether it was investigating, whether it was communications, whether it was legal, they were all teaming up together. And then when you have that, and the school system, as it did certainly in 2021, but continues to step in it with bad decisions, we were holding them accountable, and everything became a story, because obviously in Virginia in 2021, it was the gubernatorial election and the focus was on Virginia. So we were able to shine a spotlight of accountability on what was happening in our school district, but ultimately what's happening in school districts all across the country.
Right. And I think that after, you know, as a result of the lockdowns, people did get a little peek inside the classroom around the country, which was maybe one of the few positive aspects of that whole thing. And they discovered this racially divisive, you know, lessons and extreme hysteria around COVID, of course, and also transgender, which brings me to that the issue, I think, that created the spark in Loudoun County, and that is this guy in a dress raped a girl, and then he was transferred to another school where he raped another girl. Now, this was something that, as bad as that is, which should have been a national scandal, it was covered up by the local school committee. Is that right?
Yeah, basically. So there was a rape. The first instance was a rape. The second one was actually an abduction and a sexual assault. But if you go back to that first incident, there's another thing that happened right at the same time that both had to do with this policy that would allow biological males to use girls' bathrooms, among other things. You had a teacher that went up and spoke at a school board meeting opposing this policy before it was passed, this teacher Tanner Cross. They put him on suspension for that. And the very day that the first sexual assault happened, his lawyers sent a notice to the school and the media that we were going to sue. So they were dealing with two issues that directly impacted this policy that was really a signature policy of the then chairwoman. And, you know, there was a smoking gun email that was later found that, yes, this sexual assault, it's related to policy 8040. And when the superintendent was asked about it at a school board meeting a month later, you know, are there any sexual assaults in our bathrooms? He said, to my knowledge, I'm not aware of any records of sexual assaults in the bathrooms. And we found out, yeah, he was absolutely aware, as was the school board the day it happened. But nobody ever corrected the record. They just let it go. They never did anything. They moved the kid to another school where he was wearing an ankle bracelet, and he committed a second sexual assault. And, you know, parents were on top of that. You know, when that second sexual assault happened, we learned about it through a sheriff's press release. And I mean, you had dozens of parents really crowdsourcing information to communicate it that, hey, this is the same kid and they moved him to a different school. And, you know, it really exploded even further at that point. And, you know, that's one of the things I talk about in Parents of the World Unite is how all these parents really, you know, use strategies and tactics to push back against this, you know, $1.6 billion bureaucratic organization, which seems intimidating. But if you're able to sort of look at things objectively, try and outthink, outwork, outnumber the opposition, you know, they are very cumbersome. They have to decide everything through committee. You know, we were more nimble and we were able to stay ahead of the game and continue to show just how they were abusing their power to the detriment of both academics and, more importantly, safety.
Right. And I think that you were very successful in terms of turning it into a national issue. It got coverage even in the liberal-leaning mainstream media. They couldn't ignore it. I think what added to it further was that the girl who had been raped, her father showed up at a school board meeting, and he got a little emotional, and he was arrested. And you know, here he is defending his daughter and saying, hey, you did nothing. You covered this up. And then you had McAuliffe, who was the favored gubernatorial candidate, all the establishment behind him, former Clinton fixer. you know, former governor, who says in a debate completely tone deaf that parents, that you know, the experts in the schools should be deciding how to educate children, not the parents. And I think that was very revealing, and that kind of further spotlighted the very issues that you're getting into in your book.
Yeah, I think that's right. And, you know, we structure the book, and it's in 12 chapters. Each chapter is sort of a strategic or philosophical rule. But one of the overarching themes in the book is how we approached everything. I mean, there were a lot of different issues, from, you know, school safety to First Amendment rights of teachers and students to cancel culture, critical race theory, gender ideology. But our focus at the top level was abuse of power. And we kept finding that all over the place, because a lot of these policies and these actions from the school are not popular with the constituency. So right. In order to get these things through, they have to cut corners. They have to cover things up. They have to violate Freedom of Information Act rules and laws. They have to violate people's constitutional rights. And that was our focus, is find them doing that and expose that. I mean, I liken it to, you know, an Elliot Ness strategy with Al Capone, where, you know, you didn't get them on bootlegging, you didn't get them on murder, but you did get them on tax evasion. And when you kind of have that approach, you're able to not necessarily stay on one topic all the time, but be flexible and understand where the issue is, and then you can win hearts and minds of people that may not be focused 100% on critical race theory or gender ideology, but they do right. not like abuse of power.
Well, you know, Ian, it's a good thing that you're a trained lawyer. You graduated BU Law School here in Boston, and you bring a legal mind and a legal mentality to it, which is very helpful. And it's a sort of a dispassionate way to get something done, and to really kind of zero in on what exactly is going on here from a legal standpoint, and where are there potential liabilities for implementing this policy that most people despise, and that at least most people would expect that they could be informed about it. One of the most appalling aspects of this whole event in Loudoun County, and it's going on across the country right now, certainly here in Boston, is that the children are being told not to discuss what they're doing or learning with their parents, even things that are as important as, hey, I've decided that I want to be a boy, or something like that. So they give them a boy's name, and they say, don't tell your parents, because, you know, they're replacing the authority of the parent with themselves. That to me is the worst part of this. If parents in a community like that, fine. The point is that it should be there should be transparency and information made available at every step of the way.
So, yeah, and you'll find that those policies are usually not contained in policies that are debated before the public. They're usually slipped in a regulation or an interpretation of the policy. You know, but one of the unfortunate ironies here is that, you know, parents send their children to school and trust that their teachers will be the experts in teaching calculus and trigonometry and history and English and, you know, sure, reading and writing. They don't trust them to be the experts in social issues or moral issues that are right. traditionally the role of the parent. And what we're seeing is that it's flipped, so that schools are focused now on being the parent and teaching their version of morals and their version of ethics. And the academics suffer at school, and then parents have to work with their children more at home to catch them up on academics because they're not getting the proper training in school. It's completely backwards. Schools have become social indoctrination centers, and homes have become where you have to really catch up on the academics.
Well, you know, I mean, look, one of the problems that I think we as parents who are concerned about this are facing is that it didn't just fall out of a tree here. This didn't happen overnight. It's been going on, and it's been developing going back to the 1960s, and some of the psychologists and the critical race theorists, or the critical theorists, I should say, who were doing just that. They wanted to replace the authority of the parent, the authority of faith, with themselves, with the state, and with the apparatus of the state, which is the public school. So now we have parents who grew up with that kind of indoctrination, there's a psychological component of conformity that has been very studied by the CIA. I don't want to get too into it, but the Naval Department and the Department of Defense has done research on it, how to get people, condition people to accept things with social pressure and with groupthink. And so you have what we're up against here are parents who don't understand this issue and who actually support these things and who think that it's right. I mean, for their own children, which is very strange, but so be it. You'd think that, the parental instinct might kick in, especially for the mothers, but, you know, whatever.
And, you know, that's chapter one of my book, Rule Number One, Every Neighborhood is a Battlefield. Because, you know, and not that, you want to turn your neighborhood into a battlefield, but it already is. I mean, you have people that, you know, they want to be accepted, they want to be valued, and they feel this is their path in, right? Where, you know, these policies, these ideas, and them standing up for these ideas makes them somehow, you know, paragon of a new civil rights movement. But then, of course, they take it way too far, and it's, you need to believe what I believe. You need to raise your children the way I want you to. You need to live your life the way I want you to. And if you don't, then you're going to suffer consequences from this groupthink or from these mobs of people. I mean, we call them Chardonnay Antifa up here, but it is true. And, you know, a lot of people don't pay attention to what is going on day in and day out in schools. They're not, you know, necessarily dug into the issues like a lot of the parents out there that are showing up at school board meetings. Unfortunately, those are the parents that sometimes find their children, you know, going to school and claiming to be a different sex, and they don't even know about it because they're not tuned in to what's happening. And then when they find out about it, you know, they're shocked and they don't know what to do. And it's unfortunate that it has to take those events. But really, that's the problem we have is sort of winning the hearts and minds of people and getting them to really wake up to what is happening in the schools, not listening to the narrative that you hear where they say, well, they don't want to teach accurate history, or they want to ban books. Like, listen, you know, that's one of the most absurd things I've ever heard. The government paying for books to go in a library and making a decision on what books the government should pay for is not banning books. I mean, certainly people would be in favor of, you know, putting the anarchist cookbook in kindergarten and letting a child explore their bomb-making identity. So I'm not really sure, you know, how putting materials that, you know, allows them to explore their gender identity is any more appropriate.
Well, it's not banning books. It's simply saying that there are some books that are not appropriate for children. And that's something that up until, I don't know, recently, was kind of a given. You know, I mean, what, you know, it's like putting a warning label on a package of cigarettes. You know, you want to let people know what's going on inside so that they can be informed. Whatever happened to trigger laws, you know, which, of course, is something that you think that the left was into. But as far as the books go, there have been parents and young students who have stood up in school board meetings. It's, you can see these videos, at least you could, maybe not right now, they might have been censored, but for a long time they were on YouTube, where they just simply read the content of the book and they show the pictures in front of the school board. And they're things that by any conventional metric would be seen as pornography. How do they explain why this is necessary? I mean, I get the fact that adults, some adults like that, fine. They go to a place, they get a magazine and a wrapper. But why, how do they justify that for children? What exactly are children supposed to benefit from in that regard?
Well, you know, what they do is they try and tug at the heartstrings and say, you know, you have a book and it's an LGBT book. And, you know, children need this book because we need to be inclusive of you know, different points of view and different identities. And if children don't have this, then they're not going to feel included, which, you know, of course, is ridiculous. You know, you can get that book if you're a parent and you want to get your child that book on Amazon, go right ahead. But it shouldn't be sitting in a classroom library with 25, 30 kids as anybody can pick it up and decide to read it. That is something that should be a parent's decision, not a teacher's decision. And, you know, when we talk about this, and I talk about this in the book as well, in a chapter, a rule called, you know, Make Your Fight Must See TV. And in May of 2021, I think that's you know, probably where a lot of this started. We had a bunch of moms. They had placards with the words from a book, and they held up the placards and then read the lines from the back of the placards. And you could see the discomfort from the school board members, but they don't do anything about it. And I think a lot of them end up surprised because this ultimately, you spend big money, you get some contractor that might be connected to somebody in the administration, and they just start sending books, you know, and it's all about the money. Follow the money. Who's paying for it? What's the connection? And then it ends up in your libraries. And once it's in the library, once it's in the classroom library, it becomes a lot harder to get out.
Right. And also, I mean, look, being tolerant toward alternative families and whatnot, that's one thing. But how is that advanced by books that give, if you don't mind my using a pun, blow-by-blow details? I mean, this is like, is this really what you want to put in the schools? That is an endorsement of things that, you know, are not appropriate anyway, but even if one thinks they are, you don't want to have the government and the official school, you know, putting a good housekeeping seal of approval on that. The other factor that's come to light recently is this really strange business of drag queens reading nursery school and young children books. When my daughter was in public school, only parents would go in and read the books to the children. I did it. And, you know, it was kind of like off limits to anyone else. Why all of a sudden now are they bringing drag queens in? What is children supposed to learn from that?
You know, again, I think it's driven by parents, right? It's driven by parents that think this is okay and are trying to prove
a point. But how do they explain it? Why is it okay?
Because it's inclusive. They want to expose their children to all different kinds of lifestyles.
Inclusive of what? I mean, drag is an adult entertainment for people who like it.
You're not going to get a disagreement from me, but I'll tell you, that's what I hear. That's what I hear from them. It's really, I mean, you're talking about 5-6-year-olds. Don't they have anything else they'd rather be doing, you know, running around outside, riding their bikes, playing soccer, you know, than going to a drag queen show? But again, it's like, if you want to take your kid to a drag queen show on your own private time, I mean, that's between you and your future kid. But if you want to pay for it with government funds, if you want to put it in schools, well, that is a very different story. Again, it all comes down to what is the government doing here? They're legislating morality, their version of morality, which goes against the vast majority of the people which they serve. And again, they continue to try and cut corners because they know that.
Right. And also some of these drag queen videos are really gross and disgusting. And, you know, I don't even think most adults hopefully would want to have anything to do with it. It just, I guess that maybe the best approach to that is the kind of approach that I'm trying to imply here, which is, please explain to me what this is supposed to do for a child. How does a child benefit by this? I mean, you know, what's going on here? The issue of critical theory is something that I think is becoming extremely ingrained in the schools at this point. The son-in-law of the Attorney General Merrick Garland runs a multi-million at least, if not billion, educational organization that received a huge grant from the Zuckerberg Foundation to basically teach critical race theory in schools. And at the same time, the FBI, this shadowy left-wing group called the National School Board Association, sent Merrick Garland, the father of this couple, a letter asking him to criminalize parents and call them, quote, domestic terrorists, unquote, if they went to the school board and exercised their constitutional right as parents to criticize critical race theory. What's going on with that? I mean, that's pretty intimidating because the FBI said that they would, it was exposed, but I don't know. Are they still like creating these lists and looking at people as domestic terrorists?
Well, you know, the House Weaponization Committee released a report yesterday, which really went into it. They received, you know, the FBI and the DOJ received a lot of pushback from local law enforcement. You know, there wasn't some you know, big national threat to school boards. It was parents showing up. And, you know, most of the things that they were flagged for or that they reported to the FBI weren't considered threats. But, you know, they want to show like we're the victims, right? We're the victims of these angry parents. Let's show the world that they're the bad guys and we're the good guys. But, you know, the other thing that was in that report that was very interesting is the timing of that NSBA memo and the Attorney General memo, which was the end of September, the beginning of October 2021. What was happening in 2021? Terry McAuliffe was running against Glenn Youngkin, and Glenn Youngkin was starting to surge because he was embracing the parents' movement that was taking place in Virginia. And, you know, if they thought that that somehow was going to help, that was actually going to chill First Amendment rights, it didn't. It didn't at all. I mean, people kept showing up. They kept making their voices heard. They knew that they weren't doing anything wrong. They understood what the laws were, and they understood that this was a stunt from the federal government, but a very scary and dangerous stunt to weaponize, you know, the largest law enforcement bureau in the country, along with the Department of Justice, to intimidate parents who are merely speaking out at school board meetings. And yeah, some of those speeches can get angry. Some of them can get hostile, but I've not seen a single, you know, act of violence committed at a school board meeting, certainly one that would necessitate a federal agency getting involved like it would, you know, a interstate ring to create domestic terrorism.
Right. I mean, even if there was an incident, I mean, that's still a local, you know, law enforcement situation. I mean, most of the school board meetings, I assume, have a couple of people on staff who are, you know, there as a security. It's not like something that requires the federal government to come in and send, you know, guys with dressed as ninjas to sort of pick somebody up. And I think the reason that Glenn Youngkin also won is because he fielded a team of lawyers who understand voter fraud and were on call at the drop of a dime in case anybody wanted to report an incident, and that he fielded thousands of volunteers to man the voting booths and to work in the counting rooms and other people, you know, grandparents, teenagers, anybody who had a little time who wanted to get involved in ensuring that it was a clean election. And I think the result is that Virginia probably had the cleanest election they've had since Thomas Jefferson. I'm not even sure that one was so clean. But, you know, the point is that that's a model for the country, and it takes courage to do it. It takes a lot of perseverance, but it's certainly one way that people, parents, as I say, anyone who has a little time can get involved in public life and get involved with helping to save their country. I'm concerned about, I mean, where does the parents' revolution stand now, not only in Loudoun County, but given that you're one of the leaders of this movement, where are you nationally?
Well, you know, I think you look around and it really depends on the states, but I think a couple of things are sort of happening at different state levels. I mean, you're starting to get bills passed that ban using, you know, puberty blockers, hormone therapy, surgeries on minors. You're getting school choice in different states. You're getting, you know, greater transparency rules in different states. Now, that's not, unfortunately, every state, but the fact of the matter is those states have really latched on policy-wise to what parents have been asking for across the country. Now, you know, one of the things that's going to happen from that, I think, is when you think about school choice, it allows parents to take their children out of the schools that they believe are failing them and move them to a different school. But it's also going to create an effect from state to state, because if parents are feeling that, well, I can't send my child to the school I want in this state, but if I move to that state, well, I'm going to be able to do that. So you're going to start to see a bleed from states to pro school choice states over the next couple of years. And I certainly think at, you know, in places like Virginia and other sort of purple states, there's a lot of work that needs to be done, certainly to overcome, you know, the opposition where you have much smaller margins to get these things passed. But I think, you know, in elections going forward, these need to be front and center issues. People cannot take their foot off the gas. You know, that's another rule in my book. I think chapter 10, it's when you have them on the ropes, go for the knockout. And that's not to say we, you know, have the educational industrial complex on the ropes yet, but in individual spots, we are starting to get there. And it's imperative that parents recognize this has taken decades for the left to really hijack the education system. It's not something that's going to be solved in 3 years or with one election. It's going to take a while, and you're going to need to keep pushing and keep bringing new people into the fold. And fortunately, you have a ready-made pipeline, which is new parents that are now sending their children to kindergarten. They've been seeing everything that's going on as well. They're going to be ready to take up the fight, because ultimately there are more of us than there are of them. And it just really comes down to executing the right strategies, the right tactics, and operationalizing that to make sure that, you know, we hold these school systems accountable, but we're also to make change, able to make changes electorally and policy-wise.
Right. And I also would urge people who are aware of what we're talking about here, who are parents, to treat their fellow parents with kindness and care. Because if you come down like a ton of bricks, you're going to lose them. It's a better approach to sort of carefully and slowly and with a spirit of kindness and friendliness, introduce a few kernels of what you're thinking and what's going on. And over time, those kernels will sprout. You can't really, you know, come at this thing with both fists. The other ticking time bomb, I think, in this is that these children who are being sexually abused with surgeries, which I would connote with what the Nazis did to Jewish children in concentration camps. And in a way, it's worse, because at least the Nazis weren't pretending that they were doing something good to the children. They knew it was evil. That these children, more and more of them, are going to wake up and realize that their lives have been destroyed, that they've been physically assaulted and damaged. And they're going to start to speak up. There's going to start to file lawsuits. And they're going to start to do things like maybe they shouldn't do, like maybe take matters into their own hands with regard to some of the ghouls who have been doing this to them. So I think that's something that's coming down the pike. I hope it happens sooner than later, in that more and more children maybe will be saved from this really despicable program of physical engineering.
Yeah, and you're starting to see, you know, detransitioners come out. Chloe Cole has been a leading spokesperson for that. You know, she's sued Kaiser Permanente. But really, it does come back to the schools. I call it the school to scalpel pipeline, because you start early. You start in, you know, kindergarten, and you get to see the book in the library, right? It feels good to be yourself, where, you know, you learn that your doctor guessed at your sex when you were born. And then you can tell your parents when you're 5 years old that, I'm not really a girl, I'm a boy, and that they should be accepting if you're lucky. So you start putting that in children's head at an early age with some of these materials and these books. And then you focus a lot of this, you know, social emotional learning on, you know, this is normal. This, you know, Christianity and religion is wrong on this. We've advanced the point where, you know, sex is fluid. Next thing you know, you get into your preteen years and, you know, you might be feeling a little awkward, and you've got a group of people that are starting to identify as a different sex. And, you know, they're treated as a super status, right? They're given civil rights that you wouldn't have otherwise. That becomes very appealing to some kids, right? That's the social contagion aspect. And so they end up going down that path. You go down that path and you start continuing. Next thing you know, you're on TikTok, you're on Snapchat, you're looking at binders for girls, you're looking at puberty blockers, hormone therapy, and then ultimately surgery. And this is, I mean, it is appalling to see what happens, especially all this while the social transitioning is happening at school. The schools not only don't tell you about it, but they're okay with it. And they, in fact, kind of encourage it. And so it's extremely dangerous. And there are so many different, you know, whether you're talking about critical race theory, that's one issue. But then this is an issue that has direct physical consequences that are irreversible, that could change a child's life before they're ready to make any kind of decision like that. And the fact that our government at the highest levels, Rachel Levine just said it last week, the Biden administration, President Biden, Vice President Harris, are condoning this and encouraging it, while we look at Europe and we see Europe is pulling back on it. And they're saying, you know what, this needs to be treated, you know, with psychotherapy.
It's been banned in Denmark and Finland, I believe. And because they see that these drugs actually are weakening the skeletons of children. I mean, we're talking about serious physical problems associated with it. And we have the very bizarre statement by Biden, not that he makes a lot of sense anyway, but that somehow it's a sin to oppose this and it's cruel. But look, I think that, I would just, as a note of warning, if they're going to be going around and taking people's names and addresses, I am fearful that between now and the next election, especially if they don't take Trump out, which they're doing, I've never seen the level of attack on him, then there's going to be instances that are going to involve Antifa and that are going to make the George Floyd burnings of neighborhoods look like like kindergarten. There'll be some kind of spark, whether it's set up by someone or not, doesn't matter. And I just fear for patriots and who are going to have to confront what could only be described as a violent communist revolution and insurrection. Somehow this seems to work in their favor. So we all have to be careful. You know, it could be any one of us who might be caught in the crossfire.
Yeah, well, you know, I can tell you here, we had our school board meeting, the one that you referenced earlier, where the dad was arrested. And that certainly felt like a setup. I mean, they were debating this transgender policy. It felt like, you know, this was something where they were hoping for an incident, and ultimately they got an incident. And that incident made national news, and it was used to portray parents as insurrectionists and domestic terrorists, and was cited by the NSBA. But lo and behold, the truth actually came out on that one and completely destroyed their narrative that, you know, the father that they were holding up as the poster child for this was there because his daughter had been raped in a bathroom at a school, you know, 3 weeks earlier. Yes. So, you know, I think it's important for parents to stay vigilant, to understand that, you know, they're going to set traps for you as well. You can set traps for them. They can set traps for you. You know, they're going to try and infiltrate your groups, but on the other side, you can infiltrate their groups as well. So, you know, if they want to play that game, they'll find that there are smarter people on the other side that are better at it.
Well, you know, the other thing that really is in a way shocking to me is that I understand that the far left is going to embrace things like transsexuality or whatever you want to call it and all of that because it's subversive. And they are subversive and they are revolutionary. They want to change human nature. They want to abolish their antinomian. They want to abolish the law of nature. But what shocks me is that there's always been that element. In every generation, there's been that element. But I've never seen it reach such a mainstream level as it has right now in this country, where you have the president, you have, you know, cabinet members, and you've got high level people across the board who are openly and quite brazenly not only advocating these subversive ideas and policies, but that they've normalized it. That in a sense, they've now created a situation where the normal of us are the subversives. So I find that shocking. It's from a sociological standpoint. What do you think?
I mean, I think it's social media. I mean, I think you have to look at the rise of social media. Yeah. And, you know, in the past, there was a gate of information and you had to achieve a certain level of credibility to pass that information along. And, you know, based on your name, based on your work record, based on what you've done in the past, people would either trust you or wouldn't trust you. But now anybody can go out there on Twitter or Facebook and start pushing whatever.
Unless you're conservative.
Yeah, exactly. And then they start all grouping together and finding other people that have these ideas. And, you know, and then you get politicians that say, all right, well, that's our base. Now we have to appeal to them. And it creates this vicious cycle where, all right, it works. Let's keep talking crazy. We're going to get more crazy people all pooled together in their little social media echo chambers. And then the politicians just continue to, you know, give them voice to impact policy.
Indeed. And there's also a huge amount of money behind this. You have to follow the money and realize who's financing this and why. Anyways, Ian Pryor, I want to thank you for joining me. Please let my listeners and viewers know where they can get your excellent book or any other information that you may care to share?
Sure. You can get it on Amazon. You can get it on Barnes & Noble, Target, Books A Million, any retailer, really. I would encourage people to buy one, buy a second one, send it to your woke neighbor or your woke friend, and give it to him for April Fool's Day. And you want to follow me, I'm at Ian D. Pryor on Twitter.
Right. The book is Parents of the World Unite, How to Save Our Schools from the Left's Radical Agenda. It's also available on my commerce page, the Moskowitz Village Market. Ian Pryor, listen, I admire your courage. I appreciate what you're doing. You know, let's stay in touch. If there's anything that develops, please contact this show. Like to have you on anytime. And thank you very much, sir.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Take care.
You too.
Thank you.